Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And so I'd like to start the discussion about Canto 4, actually, with some of Byron's own words.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two parts that I wanted to read. This particular issue prefaces, where he says to his old friend and travelling companion Hobhouse, he says, "My dear Hobhouse, after an interval of 8 years between the composition of the first and last cantos of Childe Harold, the conclusion of the poem is about to be submitted to the public. In parting with so old a friend, it is not extraordinary that I should recur to one still older and better, to one whom has beheld the birth and death of the other, and to whom I am far more indebted for the social advantages of an enlightened friendship than, though not ungrateful, I can or could be to Childe Harold for any public favour reflected through the poem on the poet, to one whom I have known long and accompanied far, whom I have found wakeful over my sickness, and kind in my sorrow, glad in my prosperity, and firm in my adversity, true in counsel and trusty in peril, to a friend often tried and never found wanting, to yourself." And again, I just think that's such a remarkable passage. It's...
I don't think AA would like it. It hasn't got full stop for half the paragraph.
There's something as well here about the fact that people actually just wore their hearts on the sleeves far more.
Oh, yeah.
In today, it almost feels like we're scared to communicate to one another how deeply we actually feel about one another. And part of this is because of how restrictive and reductive the use of English language has become. People simply just don't know how to write like this anymore.
Yeah.
But I think the two actually go hand in hand with one another. I think that people are afraid to convey, because again, this is a lifelong friend, and that the language reflects this.
Also, I think it's probably hang-ups just left over from Victorian polite society as well.
Yeah.
If I wrote that to you, and someone else saw it,
be like, that was weird.
Gay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you would. Yeah, be like, gay. But there is something wonderful about it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that this is, it reflects just in that one paragraph, the sort of man that Byron was. Like, everything, he was a sensitive young man, right?
Yeah.
And everything that he felt extremely deeply, whether it be friendship or vengeance or whatever it may be.
He was an emo.
Yeah. And then there's one more thing that I just wanted to draw on as well, because this comes back to something we were discussing the very beginning in part one of this discussion, which is that with regard to the conduct of the last canto, there will be found less of the pilgrim than in any of the preceding, and that little slightly, if at all, separated from the author speaking in his own person. The fact is that I had become weary of drawing a line which everyone seemed determined not to perceive, like the Chinese and goldsmith citizen of the world, whom nobody would believe to be Chinese. It was in vain that I asserted and imagined that I had drawn a distinction between the author and the pilgrim, and the very anxiety to preserve this difference and disappointment at finding it unavailing so far crushed my efforts in the composition that I determined to abandon it altogether, and have done so. The opinions which have been or may be formed on that subject are now a matter of indifference. The work is to depend on itself and not on the writer and the author, who has no resource in his own mind beyond the reputation, transient or permanent, which is to arise from his literary efforts, deserves the fate of authors. So you can see him just being like, all right, fine. If you're going to insist that there's no distinction between Harold and me, then I will just do away with any pretense. But it's like, it's still saying, I insist that there was a distinction.
And I believe him.
Yeah.
I do believe him.
Well, you know what? You are right, and I believe it too, and I've thought about this more, and I think one of the things that it reflects upon is the fact that in many ways, even from the beginning, I think, in part one, Harold, I think, represented the man that Byron wished he was.
Yeah, yeah.
That's who he represents.
Yeah.
He is a man who, yeah, fine, he's, you know, lived up a life of hedonism in London. But Byron always wished he could be Harold, that he could pull away from those glorious or tragic, you know, fits of passion and ecstasy and actually just draw himself out into the land of nature and wonder beyond temptation, beyond corruption, so that he could live a more Christian existence.
Yeah.
Because it tortured him. And Byron always... For whatever people think of him and the people that he surrounded himself by, people purely atheists like Percy Shelley, Byron did always insist on his religiosity. He always insisted on his being a believer and got very defensive when people tried to strike against him on that note. And so, yeah, he longs to be this stoic Harold who could break free from these passions, but never could really. And so, of course, this brings us to a final canto. The longest canto, and because it's running up to five, the one we'll have to cover in the shortest amount of time, but challenge accepted.
Yeah,
which
it's
is
probably my least apart from the end, it's probably my least favorite canto anyway. So,
really,
yeah, I just find it a bit goes on a bit, you know.
It is extensive, it is very extensive. Let's begin with, as we always do, stanza one, shall we? I stood in Venice on the bridge of sighs, a palace and a prison on each hand. I saw from out the wave her structures rise, as from the stroke of the enchanter's wand, 1,000 years their cloudy wings expand around me, and the dying glory smiles o'er the far times when many a subject land looked to the winged lion's marble piles, where Venice sate in state, throned on her 100 isles. And he goes on. So he begins by just talking about the pure enchantment that the very word Venice summons in the minds of people.
Yeah.
And he talks about the castle and the prison, right? And so you have two things on there at the same time. You know, they're both symbolic. One is symbolic, of course, of the majesty and the civilizational grandeur of Venice. And then you have the prison. And it's really talking about how crushing Venice now is.
Yeah.
It's talking about how these two things always work in tandem. On the one hand, you have this great civilizational vitality, but at the same time there, because you have civilization, you must always have suppression as well. Yeah. And this is, to because you are right, it goes on for a very, very long time. So just to kind of go through some of the main talking points of what Byron discusses here, he talks a lot about Tasso. He talks about Torquato Tasso. He begins to talk about Dante when he goes to Florence. He begins to talk about Boccaccio. And he begins to talk about Petrarch, who was a very, very famous poet and someone that I've spoken about briefly before, very famous for the Petrarchian sonnet, which Shakespeare employs in Romeo and Juliet. To convey why they fall, very, very clever language by Shakespeare employs to explain why they fall in love at first sight. And he does it through a Petrarchian sonnet. And of course, Dante needs no introduction. He's one of the most famous poets of all time, but also a writer who was very much persecuted in his own time and found himself exiled from his own Florence.
Well, there's an element of Dante to Byron. As well.
Well, this is what the overarching theme is, isn't it? Whenever he's talking about these writers, he's always talking about a society that wishes to crush individual creativity, people who have minds of their own. Because on the one hand, innovation is remarkable. Innovations in war, innovations in agriculture, all of these things can lead to productivity and can lead to abundance and can
freedom,
all these sorts of things. But civilization also requires a certain level of conformity as well.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that he talks about towards the end of Canto 3 with the storm, how the storm is a storm on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to satiate the opinions of this man or this institution.
Yeah.
It just gets to be its authentic self.
Yeah.
And so he's constantly referring back to nature, again, using that natural imagery to bring about these moral points. But then we also have, of course, the question of decline.
Yes.
And which is, of course, very prominent. And I've made a note here to read from stanza 11. So I'll go to that. The spouseless Adriatic mourns her lord, and annual marriage now no more renewed. The bucentaur lies rotting unrestored, neglected garment of her widowhood. Saint Mark yet sees his lion where he stood, stand but in mockery of his withered power, over the proud place where an empress sued, and monarchs gazed and envied in the hour, when Venice was a queen with an unequalled dower. The Swabian sued, and now the Austrian reigns, an emperor tramples where an emperor knelt, kingdoms are shrunk to provinces, and chains clank over sceptred cities, nations melt from power's high pinnacle, when they have felt the sunshine for a while and downward go, like lawine loosened from the mountain's belt. Oh, for 1 hour of blind old Dandolo, the octogenarian chief, Byzantium's conquering foe. Before St. Mark still glow his steeds of brass, their gilded collars glittering in the sun. But is not Doria's menace come to pass? Are they not bridled, Venice lost and won? Her 1300 years of freedom done sinks like a seaweed into whence she rose. Better be whelmed beneath the waves and shun, even in destruction's depths, her foreign foes, from whom submission wrings an infamous repose. So again, just obviously every stanza is written with enviably beautiful language, like every single one of them.
Yeah.
But as well here, I mean, he's talking about the fact that Venice was not just some small city-state. It was a place that, because of its maritime power, punched above its weight time and time again. A lot like, not dissimilar to Scotland, you know, as a nation that has always historically punched above its own weight. When you look at the raw logistics of what it had to deal with, you look at like, Scottish landscape and stuff, and you know, stuff like that. And here as well, the fact that Venice is a city born out of the water. You look at like what it began with, and the fact that, as he harkens on here with old Enrico Dandolo, Bo and I, in my younger years before I joined full time, we talked about the Fourth Crusade and Dandolo's part in it. And look, on the one hand, Dandolo was a remarkable figure, a man over 90 years old.
I haven't read about him.
He was over 90 years old when the crusaders of the Fourth Crusade came to him and told him, if you will, we've come here, we all want to go to the Holy Land to retake Jerusalem. And he basically says to them, well, we'll have a deal. You will pay me 33,000 francs, whatever, florins. I can't remember what it was. And I will build you this number of ships. And essentially, one thing leads to another, escalation of events. Christians end up sacking the Christian city of Zadar, modern-day Croatia, and then obviously ends up leading to the sack of Constantinople. And so, obviously, morally repugnant to be killing another Christian kingdom, and weak, crippling a key Christian power, regardless of Greek Orthodox distinction, whatever it may be, and weakening it in such a way that the Ottomans were able to obviously end up walking over it.
Yeah.
But the fact is that Dandolo remarks on here as well, these the gilded collars, steeds of brass. Dandolo, once he arrived in Constantinople himself, was responsible for one of the worst cultural vandalisms of all time. Up there with Nero and the burning of Rome, up there with the French Revolution, up there with Henry VIII and the monasteries. I mean, you're looking at a man who was burning down the brasses and riches of antiquity.
Right.
But Byron's making a point. This, from this one city-state of Venice, this is a state that changed the world.
Yeah.
And now it finds itself subjugated.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes through all of these points about decline, and he goes on to, I simply don't have time to read every stanza again. Always goes without saying, I very much encourage people to read these things for themselves after you've heard us analyze them. But then we get this very, very romantic part in stanza 19, where he just says, I can repeople with the past, and of the present there is still a for eye and thought, and meditation chastened down enough, and more it may be than I hoped or sought, and of the happiest moments which wrought within the web of my existence, some from thee, fair Venice, have their colours caught. There are some feelings time cannot benumb, nor torture shake, or mind would now be cold and numb. But from their nature will the tannin grow, loftiest on loftiest, and least sheltered rocks, rooted in barrenness where naught below of soil supports them against the alpine shocks, of eddying storms yet spring the trunk and mocks, the howling tempest till its height and frame are worthy of the mountains from whose blocks of bleak grey granite into life it came and grew a giant tree, the mind may grow the same. I really love this idea that he lifts on of just repeopling the past, right? And he just says to himself, you must have done this. You're a romantic man like I am. You must have just sat somewhere, just in quiet contemplation.
And imagined. Yeah.
Just seeing the ghosts of the people walking before you, putting the old stones back on the broken castle,
yeah,
and trying to picture it.
I think I said about Toynbee in the last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I go to places like London Paddington or whatever, I think about.
Right. Even in places where there's not even sign of decay. One could argue about London Paddington being a sign of decay, but you know what I mean. Like, it's not just relegated to derelict civilization. Mm-hmm. It's also just things that seem in good order around us now. And you think about, okay, but when people stood here centuries ago, what would this spot have looked like then? It's a very healthy thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
It's quite a gothic experiment. Thing to do as well.
Yeah, well, you know.
Talk about ghosts. Right?
Yeah, we're gothic beings, aren't we, you and I? He begins to talk about Laura and Petrarch, and obviously Laura as well. Petrarch had this woman, this ideal woman who he named Laura, that he always wrote these romantic sonnets about, and it was always supposed to be a form of unrequited love. And so there is also something here in the romantic sense of civilization as well.
Yeah.
There's a romance for something that you cannot have, whether it be in a woman or whether it be in
golden age,
old greatness that no longer exists. And obviously he relates this to Tasso as well. And then he also begins to, as it goes much further through, as he talks about all of these great writers that have inspired him. I mean, he goes on to say, he gets very personal with it. He says, you know, I dreamt of Venice since I was a boy, you know, and we all have those places. I've still got plenty that I've dreamt to visit ever since I was a child that I still haven't seen. And one of the things that I suppose is quite encouraging for a man like Byron is the fact that actually when he arrived in Venice, despite everything he's saying, he wasn't actually disappointed.
Wow, unlike he was with Grace.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. He found Venice to be very enrapturing. He found it to be very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
And even with its decay, the decay actually, worked within the quality and charm of the place itself. He was able to synthesize these two things.
So I want to talk about, just an aside, I want to talk about Spengler because I think this emphasizes the point. You know, obviously we think of a linear history from antiquity up to the modern day, whereas Spengler splits it into different civilizations, you know, Magian, the classical civilization, Western Faustian civilization.
Right.
So I found it interesting that Byron goes to Greece and he kind of finds it alien in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't describe it like that, but you can tell there's this alienation between what he's seeing and this ideal he's built in his head. Whereas when he goes to Venice, which is very much part of Western civilization, in Spengler's frame, which really begins around 1400s or whatever, he has an affinity with it. So, yeah, I just wanted to.
Why does he make the distinction between Greece and Rome as
because you see,
Greece obviously not being the precursor and the Romans adopting so much of Greek
because
culture.
Because he sees it as, it starts with mathematics, basically. He talks about how different civilizations or cultures, it begins with cultures. So there's a cultural seed, which then has its own predeterminate life cycle.
Right.
Which then ends with civilization as a Caesar-like figure, in the Roman case, or in the classical case, literally Caesar.
Mm.
He then signals the end of that civilization. Right. It collapses into the state of the fellaheen, and then another cultural seed on the periphery begins. Mm. So with Greek and Roman civilization, he talks about Euclidean geometry, right? So Greek temples and, you know, obviously the Roman architecture comes from Greek architecture, really.
Sure.
So it's very much about the internal cella and then very logically set out columns and forms. That's kind of this bounded space, right? That's what sets these cultures, defines the Roman and Greek culture, right? Or civilization. When that disappears, and you have the Gothic then coming up, what's Gothic architecture? That's how you see it, really. Mm. It's more about non-Euclidean space, i.e. massive soaring heights, loads of light caused by buttressing.
Right.
Vice versa. So there's like very much a different ethos.
Mm.
In these cultures and civilizations, and you can map that, and you can see where really one civilization died and another began. So in that sense, it's not really a linear progression.
Mm.
It's more about there's always barbarians on the outside. This gets more into Toynbee, but there's always a vital barbarian culture on the outside, which is always waiting to come in and sweep up
right
the detritus of the civilization which came before it.
Mm. Yeah, a bit like, I suppose, what Alexander the Great did to the Persian Empire.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was exactly. suffering so much and basically the wheels were coming off it by that point.
But again, it's not really a linear progression. It's more literally different things.
Mm.
You know, in the same way that you can't embody what the Roman would have thought because you're not a Roman.
No.
Right? So, again, this has implications for the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Mm. Yeah, they thought they were returning to the classical world, whereas actually you're creating a idol of it, which is very much inflected with the Western way of thinking. Western meaning Northern European, basically,
yes.
i.e. the barbarians.
Yeah, but it's interesting though, because obviously Byron, on a personal level, does feel some sense of continuity there.
Yeah.
He does obviously see there is something of a grand arc.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there is. There
from
is.
Cicero to him.
Yeah, and of course there is.
Yeah.
But there is merit to what Spengler says. But where people say this side of the political sphere is pessimistic in the sense that...
Well, I'm not.
Our civilization is eventually going to die.
Mm.
Well, actually, it's more like a sine wave. It's still, I think, because I follow Hegel and whatnot, it's moving to a definitive point.
Mm.
Just because one civilization dies doesn't mean it's not part of the same course of history, right?
Sure.
There is one history with many different forces acting within it. It doesn't mean everything's going to end one day, right?
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.